It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. Airplane crashes have affected so many Alaskans, and I know I'm no different from others. And having had friends and acquaintances who've been lost, it's something that you kind of get used to and think, oh, that's part of the Alaska experience when people disappear and never come back. Well, it turns out that may not be the case, because about 10 years ago, a program was created to study and then impact the number of air taxi crashes that happened in this state. And a study has just come out that shows that that program was amazingly effective. 57% reduction in the number of pilots who were killed from 10 years ago to the number they're being killed now. And if you look at the charts in the study that came out, it's pretty amazing. So that's going to be our topic today: aviation safety, how this program came about, how it worked, and what we might learn for making it even safer. And I've got two terrific guests today to help me talk about this, people who were involved in helping make it happen. Mary O'Connor is with the Aviation Safety Program at National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, which is part of the Center for Disease Control. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
My other guest is Jerry Rock, who's past president of the Alaska Air Carriers Association, has been involved in aviation in a whole bunch of different ways, and also involved in the safety initiative. Thanks for being with us, Jerry.
Thank you.
So let's start, Mary O'Connor, talking about how this was accomplished. The paper that came out, which was in the American Journal of Industrial Medicine, said something that on its face seems very sensible, but it's maybe something we don't often do. It says the public health model asserts that through an evidence-based scientific approach, injuries can be prevented, and that this is the best accomplished through the combined activities of diverse disciplines and organizations. Straightforward, yet we often don't seem to do that, but in this case, that sort of is the approach you took. Tell us how that came about.
The public health approach was developed to address some of the aviation safety issues after aircraft crashes were found to be the second leading cause of occupational death during the 1990s. So experts and industry representatives looked at ways to intervene in some of these crashes, and what they did was to look at where the crashes were happening, how they're happening, what type of crashes they are, identify the risk factors, and develop and implement interventions, and then evaluate and refine, and then repeat the process. And the study that just came out was the evaluation part of the effectiveness of this approach. And this approach was unique in that it used partnerships with a lot of different agencies, industry representatives, and non-governmental organizations to work together.
Okay. So the first thing I guess was to get everybody on the same sheet of music that you were going to go ahead and address this and come up with strategies and all that. That's a big part of it, analysis, right?
It is. It is. And part of the uniqueness of this initiative was that we used several different types of interventions, not just education or just enforcement. But we looked at several different ways to approach the problem.
Yeah, well, what I thought was interesting in reading the paper is you go into the statistics, you find out, well, why are the planes crashing, right? And then you try to specifically address those issues. And not only why are they crashing, but the worst crashes, the ones that cause the most deaths. And I guess as you looked at that, you found out it was situations where pilots are flying into bad weather and then they're running into terrain. So it's not that there's something wrong with the plane, not something wrong with the pilot, but with the situation that they're getting into and then figuring out how to address that.
Exactly.
So what was the sort of the, I guess there was a program to look at letting people know what the weather is out there what were the sort of ways to take care of that?
Well, we did look at ways to improve access to weather information for pilots. And one way that we found successful in giving them an idea of what the weather looked like before they even left the ground were the weather cameras, which were located in remote mountain passes and on airstrips that they might be flying to. So they could go online and look up and see what the visibility was, what the ceiling was, and make a decision based on the weather at that point. Another way that we improved the weather information was the National Weather Service worked with the Federal Aviation Administration and developed a mic-in-hand program. And what that did was provide near real-time weather information for pilots who were flying, and maybe their destination was 20 minutes away or 2 hours away, and they could get the weather as it changed. They could get that information and make a decision to either turn around or continue their flight or maybe take an alternate route.
So it's not just a pre-flight briefing, but they can actually sort of check in as they're on the way.
Exactly.
I see.
Exactly.
Let me turn to my other guest, who is from the aviation industry, Jerry Rock. It seems to me that when I've been in my share of scary flights, I've lived in Alaska all my life, been a journalist, and it seems to me that a lot of times it's just there's a lot of desire to get to where you're going, and so there's a lot of pressure on the pilot. And as I understand it, part of this program has been figuring out how to deal with the pilot behavior so that they're evaluating the risk appropriately and not being put under that pressure or learning to deal with it. How did you guys look at that issue?
Well, you're correct there. And there was a couple of programs started, you know, back in the first, I guess, area was out in the Yukon, Kuskokwim area, Yukon Delta area. And we looked at from about 92 through 98, there was almost 2.5 times the accidents of anywhere else in the state. Mm. And a lot of those CFIT accidents, controlled flight in terrain, which is 95% of the accidents, so the different organizations, the Alaska Airmen Association, Alaska Air Carriers Association, the FAA, we all looked at, you know, what was going on here too. And, you know, that was one of the pressures we saw was pilots pushing the weather. And really where we went with that particular thing is we started the Medallion Foundation here in Alaska. And that was a voluntary program to get the commercial operators, it started out as the commercial operators, to come together and do training in-house. We got a grant from Senator Stevens. That money was funneled through the FAA. And basically, that's the things we focused on, to get managers to stop pushing their pilots, but to look at, you know, different kind of programs. One of them was risk assessment, to where the pilot wasn't making these decisions on his own. There was each of the carrier, and we shared these things among the carriers. But the risk assessment form looked at lots of things, whether the pilot had plenty of sleep the night before, or whether he'd had some issues, family issues, what the weather was. But he had a basic checklist that he went through, and it had a grading system, and what the weather was, he had to look at the weather. And so it kind of let him do a self-check of the flight before he went, and actually each leg, most of the carriers use a each leg situation there. And they look at it, and it allows them either to take off and continue with their flight, or they have to check with ops, you know, wherever their ops base might be, that Bethel or Anchorage, or they couldn't fly at all. And that helped to probably take a lot of the stress away from the pilots.
Right. So you're not, and I guess everybody, whether you're a boater or whatever you do, you're always having to make these calls in Alaska. Is it safe? Is it not safe? Do we go? Do we not go? And even if you're really experienced, you're just judging it by the fact that, well, you're still alive, right? So you must have made so you're trying to make it a little bit more objective. It's not just how you feel at the moment or what you remember of your past.
Correct.
Now that we've all heard the saying, there's no there's old pilots and there's bold pilots, but there's no old bold pilots. Is there a personality thing here that has to be addressed, that some pilots want to go for it more, or is it just sort of training them so they know how to look at the risks?
No, I think you find very few air carriers that will employ pilots that are going to go out and that kind of behavior. Mm-hmm. You know, the air carriers took this on themselves. The Capstone program, Medallion program, this all started in the late 90s, early 2000. You know, there was no mandates. There was nothing that forced us to. And it was wanting to cut down on these accidents, do the insurance, different things are coming. But, you know, we just looked at all these different aspects of what was creating accidents. And, you know, we saw very quickly And you know, I don't want to pick on the Bethel area, but that was a lot of CFIT accidents, a lot of pressure with a lot of different operators operating there, and everybody, you know, competition. And, you know, so it was really a matter of the operators taking it on and, you know, training the pilots not to take these flights. And, you know, we all look at it, you know, one accident, you kill somebody or hurt somebody, you know, there's your profit probably for the next 5 to 10 years if you're still in business. So
it really is. And the competition wouldn't make any sense, obviously. You don't want them to be competing.
No, and, you know, I think it still goes on a little bit today, but as you can see in the accident results, we've really made huge gains.
It is remarkable, yeah. So our topic today is aviation safety. We've got two experts here, one from science and public health and the other from the aviation industry. And we welcome your questions and comments. We're going to talk more about how this was accomplished, this 50% improvement in pilot deaths over the last 10 years, and what other issues still need to be addressed. And I'm also interested in how these kinds of strategies, this kind of analysis, can be looked at for other industries, other areas where we have hazards, because maybe we're accepting more risk than we need to in a lot of areas of our lives. My name is Charles Wolforth. The show is Hometown Alaska. If you want to get on the air, call 550-8433, 550-8433. You can call toll-free from out of Anchorage at 888-353-5752. And we also take emails, which we read on the air, and you can address our guests or just make a comment, hometown@alaskapublic.org. And let me just call your attention to the website, because thanks to Mary O'Connor from NIOSH, we have a tremendous number of links there. Anything you want to know about this subject, you're going to find on one of these links. So for that, you just go to alaskapublic.org and just click on our show, Good News on Aviation Safety. Turning back to you, Mary, the statistics before this program started, I didn't realize just how horrendously bad they were. And according to the paper, being a pilot in Alaska is one of the most dangerous jobs in the country. And just an astounding number of people were getting killed each year. Was how in terms of analysis of is that sort of a, you view that it's, I mean, we think of accidents as being a one-off thing, but you start looking at it in terms of a pattern, and this is an area that's really dangerous, right? And that's sort of what drew the attention of NIOSH to it?
Yes, that's part of surveillance, is to look at trends and patterns. And as Jerry mentioned, the controlled flight into terrain was one area where we saw a pattern. And in that case, pilots were flying from areas of good weather into bad weather. They weren't necessarily starting off in bad weather or knowing that they were going to end up into bad weather. But for whatever reason, they continued the flight from visual flight rules conditions into instrument meteorological conditions.
Uh-huh. And those tended to be particularly fatal, because according to the paper, they're not all plane crashes are fatal, obviously. In fact, it sounds like a majority of them aren't.
That's correct.
So what would happen is somebody is starting a flight, they maybe wouldn't have the information of what it's like on the other end, or they would think, well, maybe it's not that bad, we can make it through. Then they get into the bad weather, they don't have instruments, and so they run into a mountain pass or something like that and collide with the ground.
Or they keep getting lower and lower, thinking that the ceiling will improve, and they either hit obstacles or water as well.
Let's go to a call now. Adam is calling from Anchorage. Adam, do you have a question?
Yeah, hi. Just a general statement. I'm very impressed with the gains that we've made in aviation safety in Alaska in the last decade or so. And I'd like to ask your panel there, what they see are the weaknesses of the current system and how they plan on addressing, or what the plan is for addressing those weaknesses in coming years. And I'll take my answer off here.
All right. So what are the next steps? Do you want to take that first, Mary O'Connor?
Sure. While we are seeing a reduction in CFIT crashes, they are still occurring. And what would be an area of focus is to look at the human factors and what makes pilots continue flights into poor weather? Is it because they have done it in the past and don't perceive it as being a risk and think, well, I've done this before, I can do it again? Mm-hmm. Do they just not recognize that they've flown from an area of 10 miles visibility into 2 miles visibility and it just continues to deteriorate? They don't recognize that? Or is it because of pressure? Commercial carriers have gotten some interventions in place where the decisions aren't necessarily up to the pilot, so he can always say, well, my company won't allow me to dispatch in this weather. But that pressure is not necessarily removed from the general aviation pilots who still see some of that. So I'm assuming your caller was looking at aviation overall and not just for commercial carriers.
So in other words, a private pilot.
Yes. Helping them to recognize what their limitations are, maintain proficiency, and not be afraid to say, no, I'm not comfortable mm-hmm. flying in these conditions, either because of the winds or because of the visibilities or ceilings. Mm-hmm. So looking at human factors and figuring out why pilots continue flights into poor weather and what we can do to help them make decisions that will end up with safer outcomes rather than tragic
right.
outcomes.
Well, I noticed from the study that that it was in the lower 48, there was an issue of pilot skill in some cases, but up here it looked like pilot skill was really not a big issue with the air taxi operators. But with general aviation, with a private pilot who only flies on the weekends or something, I would imagine that just basic skill would be an issue flying in some of our challenging circumstances.
And I think we've all seen the economy get a little bit tighter. Pilots that are flying 10 hours a month, maybe fly 5 hours a month in currency. It's just not the same as going to that 1,000-foot strip when they used to fly, 100 hours a year. Mm-hmm. And maintaining a proficiency to a point where you can recognize, yes, I'm comfortable doing that and I'll have a good outcome versus, well, I think we can go see or we can take a look or we'll try it this time. And being absolutely proficient and sure of your skills and your capabilities and having the ability to use some judgment and just mm-hmm. say, nope, it's beyond my capabilities
yeah.
today. Used to be
yeah.
able to do it, but I can't do it today.
And you're a pilot yourself. We didn't get into that, but tell us a little bit about your aviation experience.
I've been a pilot for over 20 years, and I have a flight instructor certificate. I'm fortunate enough to have a day job, so mm-hmm. I don't instruct or work in aviation to make a living, but I do a little bit, and I enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. And just our listeners can't see, but you're part of the U.S. Public Health Service. You're wearing a U.S. Public Health Service uniform, so I guess you could switch between an aviation uniform and a...
Well, I kept hoping that Public Health Service would institute a flight department, but that hasn't happened yet.
You got as close as you could get, I guess. So, Jerry Rock from the Air Carriers Association, what do you see in answer to the caller's question? What are some next steps or further things that could be done?
Well, I'll talk more about the equipage side. You know, we haven't talked about that yet, but a lot of these accidents, the reduction has come from the Capstone program and from the ADS-B, which is a further advancement of the Capstone program.
And just quickly tell us what those are.
Back in 1999, between the FAA, the air carriers, the airmen, we all started a program with Shelton as the equipment provider that puts in the cockpit a moving map display. Mm-hmm. And the government provided 200 units free on a grant-type basis to anybody applied for them, and we put those, and it's got a moving map display in the cockpit that gives you, back then it gave you weather, gave you terrain, and it gave you basically what other aircraft were around you, as long as they were equipped too. Mm-hmm. So that was the initiation of phase one of Capstone, and so the pilots had a lot more information in their cockpit than they had previously.
So prior to that, you might have been looking at a paper map and looking out the window and...
Correct.
Yeah.
And you needed ground-based receivers for this program to work. So the first phase of it was out in western Alaska out of the Bethel area. And then phase two moved down to southeast Alaska. And then we basically, the next area, just was turned on, it hasn't been approved because it goes through a testing phase, is the corridor between Anchorage and Fairbanks. And the next phase of that will be the North Slope and then the Aleutian Chain. But really, that gave the pilots a lot more information. And then the ADS-B, which is the next gen that everybody's going to have in 2020 in their equipage in their aircraft, is really will give weather up to date. And I think what us as the carriers are asking for, where we're seeing what we need next after we've had this equipment, is weather reporting, and weather reporting at the destination we're going to. So real-life weather reporting is what we really need next. And that's going to require some ground-based state. You know, right now it's done with outstations and people calling weather. You know, weather balloons, believe it or not, are still used. But that is what we're pushing for next on the equipage, so that people flying can still use the same display unit to show them the weather, you know, real-time weather. You know, we have the cameras. You know, we hope to link the cameras up so they'll be able to look at the passes they're going to. So that's where we see it going to next.
What they're heading into. So on these webcams, and the listeners can get in, you, it's kind of fun, you know, to look at these webcams. They're all over the state. There's a link on our website. You can just look at what's going on. But if you're in a plane, then what are you using, your iPhone to look at it? I mean, how do you get that access when you're on the plane?
Well, see, we do have people doing that. We have people actually using their iPhones now, and that's the, kind of the unfortunate part for us, for the carriers. It's kind of pushing the FAA to, you know, we've got the technology. Why can't we get this into the cockpit,
right,
too?
Right, yeah. So, let's get Apple on it. Yeah. All right, we've got a call now from Dovey in Anchorage. Question about commercial pilots.
Yes, hi. I do have a question. Mostly, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Yeah, mostly my experience, I've flown in the Bethel area and over in the Aleutians and doing different things, flying medevac and as well as 135 operation, flying cargo and passengers in the Bethel area. I haven't flown out there for about 5 years, but from what I remember, the biggest factor with regards to the accidents is, was the pressure put on the pilots by some of the owners and also the dispatchers. I'm not talking of 121 dispatchers, but some of the 135 dispatchers. I felt that there was a huge gap in professionalism when a pilot said that they were uncomfortable with the weather, did not want to fly that particular route that particular day for whatever reason they had. There was a certain amount of guilt put on the pilot at that time, and I've experienced this myself, and I've seen other pilots fall prey to this and actually lose their lives over this. And it's unfortunate. I hope it's not happening anymore, but I think that is a huge factor in those relationships between the dispatchers, the owners, and the pilots.
And what time frame were you talking about that you were working out there?
I was working out there starting in 97 and then 99, and then I worked out there again in 2005 for a summer, flying various equipment, 207s and Navajos and Merlin's Metroliners. And I just feel that the 135 operations in the state at that time, I can't speak for what's going on now because I haven't been involved, it was just a lot of very inexperienced pilots and a lot of very inexperienced dispatchers who were not professional. They were locally hired. They were not trained properly. They did not have the 121 certification that they would require if they were working at a 121 airline. Hence, there was a certain level of communication that just were not used to. They just didn't know how to politic around the nuances of, you know, when a pilot says they don't want to do something, they don't want to do something. And then that's it.
Okay.
I just think it was very unfortunate, a lot of the things that happened at that particular time. And I still stay in touch, and I still see the same things happening over and over again.
So when we're talking 135, we're talking air taxi, and 121 is more like airline. Okay. Mary O'Connor from NIOSH, do you want to respond to that? I mean, the role of the dispatcher who might be a local person.
I think that's a really good point, and I do believe in the 90s that was the case, that pilots were pressured by their companies, not just passengers, but by their companies. And I think that is one of the successes of the Medallion Foundation, because they were also charged with changing the culture of the industry to appreciate safety and to respect a safe pilot rather than a cowboy attitude or a pilot who's going to take chances and get the job done. I think for a lot of reasons, some being insurance as well as just maintaining a business, it made it more difficult once you had a crash. It made it more difficult to continue in that business. And the Medallion Foundation really did work to improve that culture and to, to change the things that we looked up to in pilots and in operators.
Well, let me turn to Jerry. You're involved in the Medallion Foundation. Do you think that there's still sort of that pressures out there from non-members? Or, I mean, can you respond to what the caller's saying about the pressures from dispatchers?
Oh, I agree what he's saying. You know, the Galena School District, I believe it's a school district there, about 4 years ago started a dispatcher school. We saw this happening, and they hold that every year now, I believe, in the spring. And so there is a lot more people being trained in dispatching than what was happening before. You know, the FAA never required a dispatcher for the long, I mean, a 121, yes, but for the 135, unless you had, you were providing medevac flights, I mean, as long as you had some kind of operational flight following system in place, you weren't necessarily required to have a dispatcher. And the industry itself has seen this as an issue, too. And really, I believe in the last 3 years, they've graduated 10 to 15 individuals a year out of that dispatching school that they have out there in Galena. So, you know, from that side, yes, from the Medallion side, you know, it is a voluntary program. And, you know, why we, you know, and today, 95% of the passengers and cargo in the state are carried by Medallion carriers. But, you know, when you look at that, that's 30, I believe we have 37 or 39 carriers that provide, that are in the Medallion program out of, you know, 270 certificates that exist in the state.
So the little guys aren't in it.
What we've seen here recently, you know, what's happened the last couple of years, and I think the Stevens crash brought it to head, is we had a big aviation summit here a year ago that the Air Carriers and Medallion Foundation put on, and we brought all the users together, and, you know, we were looking at where some of these issues still existed, and we tried to get everybody in the industry to come in, and we had a pretty good turnout, but, you know, the lodge owners, I think, still have a lot of pressure that from clients that are spending $3,500 to $4,000 a week to be there to get their clients out. And, you know, which is just a prime example of having a CFIT accident. You know, Bethel, what the caller's talking about, it's a constant battle, and we have a lot of people. We actually have one of our flight simulators out in Bethel that's available for free for anybody to use, and we encourage people to use them. And you know, I know there's still carriers that put a lot of pressure on the pilot, and I mean, we fight that issue all the time.
If your pilot's time to quit if that happens. Dove, did you have more to add to that?
No, I mean, it's good to hear that the Medallion Foundation is working hard with the carriers to make sure that that's not happening. And I think having a program for the dispatchers is a very good idea, even though it's not required by 135. It really, I think, is it's a good program to have.
All right. Thanks for your call. Here's a caller, or not a caller, but a actually, I don't know if this is a caller or an email, but in any event, it's in front of me on the computer screen, so we'll call it an email. Wants to know what the ratio is of male to female accidents based on average miles flown. I guess this is a question for you, Mary O'Connor, as the scientist. Do females have a better record than males? Is there an aggressiveness or a macho element here?
In the studies that we have done, we've looked at occupational crashes or occupational fatalities, and we don't have the numbers to say. Looking at a general aviation perspective, I couldn't say. There are so many fewer female pilots. There are less than 10% of the commercial pilots are female. So there just aren't that many out there that would give us any statistics in Alaska that would be very valid.
So from the point of view of getting enough numbers to come up with statistical analysis, any other factors that might be surprising or ways that you've cut up the data that turned up reasons why one pilot might have an accident over another?
The most surprising one to me was we looked at pilots with fewer than 6,000 hours and more than 6,000 hours, and we didn't find any significant difference in their likelihood of having a controlled flight into terrain crash.
Hmm.
So, like Jerry mentioned, the YK Delta had a lot of young and inexperienced pilots, and that could account for a lot of the younger inexperienced pilots, but then a lot of the more experienced pilots, maybe older, who had a lot of Alaska experience, could have made flights in poor weather before and had successful outcomes, so they were tempted to do it again.
Right, right. Interesting, because you don't think that the gray-haired pilot would always be the safer one, but maybe not. Interesting. Well, we're going to take a break. It's a really interesting topic. If you want to get involved, I'll be giving out the phone number and the email address right after the break. The show is Hometown Alaska. Stick with us.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Hometown Alaska, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcasts of Hometown Alaska on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. It's Hometown Alaska. My name is Charles Wolforth. Our topic today is aviation safety in Alaska, something that affects a great number of us since there's so much of Alaska you have to fly to or recreationally to get out and have your fun in there during the summertime. And it's always, if you have never felt scared in a little plane in Alaska, you probably haven't lived here that long because there are certainly scary times that happen. But It turns out that there is a way to make it a lot safer, and there's been a program in effect the last 10 years that has dramatically reduced the number of deaths, and that's what we're talking about. Mary O'Connor is with the Aviation Safety Program from the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, which is part of the Center for Disease Control, and she's been working in that program. And Jerry Rock, past president of the Alaska Air Carriers Association, is here from the industry point of view, and we'd love to hear your comments, stories, questions. The number here is 550-8433, 550-8433. That's within the Anchorage Bowl. From outside, 888-353-5752. And the email address is hometown@alaskapublic.org. Now, I want to launch on an uncomfortable and sad topic, but it's one that's sort of obviously out there, which is the fact that Senator Ted Stevens was the one who made this topic a cause, contributed a lot of money from the federal budget to deal with it, stayed on top of it. You know, you knew all the time where he was coming from on it. I'm sure he had lost a lot of people, as others have. And then he's himself killed in a controlled flight into terrain accident. And I tried to get a NTSB representative on the show today. They were out of town and couldn't make it. I guess that report is available. Sounds like a day that they shouldn't have been flying. And I don't know if either of my guests could comment. Jerry, you talked a little bit about lodge owners and sort of the different kinds of standards they might have just because they're not air taxis. Do you want to comment at all on what happened to Ted Stevens?
No, I really don't have any information there. I knew the pilot. He was a very good pilot, a longtime Alaska pilot, a friend of everybody in the industry. And, you know, there's no guessing what went on there. I mean, from the industry side, you know, the lodge owners are not air carriers. And, you know, from an air carrier standpoint, because we worry about safety, we worry about accident rates affecting insurance. The lodge owners have about a 90-day window that they work during the year. And you know, the Medallion Foundation now, we're trying to get them involved and you know, the culture. You know, we have training devices here right in Anchorage. We have a full-motion flight simulator for the PA-18 Super Cub helicopter. And you know, trying to get these folks involved to bring their pilots in the beginning of the season to just get them familiar with what's going on is part of the thing. You know, another big area that we address kind of like in the Stevens accident is down southeast Alaska. We started Q-based training here a couple of years ago. And what Q-based training is we've taken we take a map, real map, and put it into software to where the pilots can train on these devices, and basically they're flying right in the same passes, same mountainous region, glaciers as in the southeast. It's all overlaid into this, and they look for reference points. And if they don't see that next reference point, it signals them that they need to turn around and go back. So, you know, we've kind of taken that on. We've been asked to look at that in Hawaii, actually, because they have a high rate of CFIT accidents over there, too. Mm. And you'd be surprised, but because of the mountainous terrain. But, you know, that's probably the next area is out there, down there, the Woodtuckchick Lake area, trying to get Q-based training incorporated into that area, too, so that, you know, to give these pilots some, you know, I don't want to pick on the lodge owners or anything, but we're, you know, we see a pressure there because of what they're being paid to get their people
right
out to.
Plus, the lodges tend to be, if they're fishing lodges, they tend to be places with a lot of bad weather.
Yes.
I mean, let's face it. So, Mary O'Connor, I know you're not an accident investigator. Any comment on Senator Stevens' role in getting this thing going, and then comment on the terrible accident?
Senator Stevens was a huge proponent of this initiative and a real driver behind aviation safety in Alaska, and it's just a tragedy. Mm-hmm. I will echo what Jerry said about the lodge owners, and in addition to the areas that they live in, they're also limited with a hunting or fishing season, or if it's a flight-seeing operator, then they're limited by the season and have pressure to operate during those times. And from a regulatory standpoint, they fly under the regulations that cover general aviation pilots, not the higher standards that the air taxi and commuter operators follow.
I see. So when we talk about 135, those are the air taxis. That's what your program has primarily been based on. It hasn't really been looking at general aviation. Okay. Is that a next step for your program to get broadened out into general aviation?
A lot of the benefits from this initiative that we just studied are also available to general aviation pilots, like the Medallion Foundation simulators. Those were originally designed and developed for the operators, but they're available to general aviation pilots. All you need is a student pilot certificate to go in and fly one of those. Things like the weather cameras, those are all available to pilots, as well as somebody sitting in the lower 48 wondering what's happening out in Port Allsworth this afternoon, or Cordova for that matter. So a lot of the benefits have trickled down to general aviation, and I think our future interventions will as well. But my job is to address occupational fatalities and injuries, so that will always be my focus.
Right. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. You investigate where people are on the job, and it kind of brings up the importance of interagency work, doesn't it? Because everybody has their own little focus, and if you are only looking, I mean, if I'm on a plane, I don't care if it's being looked at by this agency or that agency. I want to know that I'm safe. How do you do that kind of interagency cooperation? How does that come about?
Different ways. The NTSB is charged with investigating all of the crashes. So we look at their database, and in our office, we have an Alaska injury and occupational surveillance system, and we look at all fatalities, not just in aviation, but whether it occurs in an office or in an airplane. So we use that to follow and track our occupational fatalities. Working with the FAA, they address all aviation accidents as well. So we can work with them and share our findings, and they can share our share their findings with us and look at where we may have overlap and where different areas can share information.
Mm-hmm. So NTSB, those are the guys who jump in the plane and go out there and look at the crash and try to figure out what happened. They write a detailed report. And then you're at the other end reading the report and sort of analyzing it and figuring out, well, how could this have been avoided?
Yes. Yep.
And do they do all the crashes or just the commercial? Do they look at every crash?
They look at general aviation crashes, depending on the severity. If it's an accident versus an incident and the remoteness of it, they may have a call-in report where somebody who was involved in the crash can call in and give information. Or submit it by letter.
Okay. Well, our topic today is aviation safety in Hometown Alaska. If you want to get involved in the conversation, we've still got a little time left. The number here is 550-8433. If you're outside of Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. And the email address is hometown@alaskapublic.org. I want to ask... years ago, there was an issue with helicopter logging and just a horrendous number of accidents. And I don't hear about that so much anymore. And I don't know if that's because they're not helicopter logging anymore or somebody figured out a safer way to do it. Can either of you guys address that issue? Mary, do you know what happened with that industry?
NIOSH was involved in that initiative as well, and we had done surveillance and looked at causes of crashes, how they were occurring and when they were occurring, and those results were very successful, although I do think at this point in time the amount of helicopter logging, particularly in Southeast, has gone down significantly.
Because I guess the timber values and other economic factors... Yeah. Jerry, you were involved in the helicopter industry. Are the issues there the same, different? I know that helicopters do a lot of, I'm looking for the right word, some specialized stuff that takes a tremendous amount of skill on the part of the pilot. And it's kind of a different culture from fixed wing a little bit, isn't it?
Well, I am from the helicopter industry. Pretty much my whole life's been the helicopter industry. And we still have the same culture. We still have the same issues. We still have, we fly under the same regulations. We have the same issues with pilots. I mean, CFIT accidents in the helicopter industry are just as common as they are in the fixed wing industry. Probably a few less because the helicopters have the ability to just land anywhere and sit out weather, which happens pretty regularly, where fixed wing airplanes don't have that option. But, the helicopter industry, we live under the same regulations. We fly under the same regulations. We have VFR and IFR pilots. Mm-hmm. And, it really, the helicopter side, we were co-owned by probably one of the largest logging helicopter companies in the country. And really, it has dropped up. There's hardly any helicopter logging going on in Alaska. There still is in the lower 48, and some of the latest reports. It's fatigue, metal fatigue on the aircraft is a big issue. A lot of accidents are caught in a helicopter. Your balance on that thing is off a rotor system with wind coming down, and if anything catches, be it a skid or a log, it just tends to pull you right over, and you end up that helicopter crashing. So it is a specialized, but we still fly and live under the same regulations.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was observed a tether operation picking up some debris on the southern Gulf of Alaska coast, and it was just, I couldn't believe what that guy had to do in terms of balancing his loads and keeping going the right direction. We've got a call now from Bud in Anchorage talking about the aviation and lodges. Bud?
Yeah, hi. I'm a lodge owner out in the Woodkitchick Narrows area, and I've owned it for 25 years. And just a comment, I heard you guys earlier talking about the pressure on lodges, but I get paid regardless of whether I fly or not. So if I have clients and the weather's bad, if I don't fly, I save money on fuel. So the pressure is not the same as in a 135 operation.
Okay, interesting point. So what you're saying is basically the person has put down their deposit. If the weather's bad and they can't get there, then the money is, you're not going to give them back their money.
That's correct. They pay a fee for the whole week. And if we have bad weather and my pilots are stay home all day, frankly, I save money. I don't burn as much fuel. So we don't have the same pressure that a 135 operator has. I'm also a 135 operator, and we do some 135 flights, but predominantly we're Part 91 to AeroLodge.
All right. Thanks. Any response to that, Jerry?
No, I agree with Bud. You know, they have a really nice lodge down there, and they you know, it's the same thing that we see in the 135 operations. There's a lot of good people doing everything right, and you have a few people that aren't, and I think that's kind of where you see the differences. But you know, most of the lodges are well run, their aircraft are well maintained, and I mean, for the most part, they do a good job.
Well, from my point of view as a passenger, this is the thing that's always bugged me is, you know, the folks in the industry will know who the good operators are. Probably the folks who live in a little town are going to know who they feel safe with. But if you're new, you have no way of knowing. And Mary, is there any way for the passenger to protect themselves in terms of knowing if this is a safe operator and also knowing if it's safe to go on a flight?
One way of looking at operators is to see if they have any of the medallion stars or are participants in the SHIELD program.
Mm-hmm.
They can look for capstone equipment.
I guess you can check that on the website before you even call them up. Yeah.
Exactly. Or you could call them and ask them. One of the programs that was part of this initiative was the Circle of Safety program, and that was developed by the Federal Aviation Administration, and that empowered passengers to educate them and let them know that it was okay to ask a pilot, what are your ratings, what kind of flight plan are we on, where is our safety equipment, or if they didn't get a briefing or if they didn't hear the safety briefing, they can ask any questions about the fire extinguisher or how to open a door. And the Circle of Safety program is still in existence. And I understand that the Medallion Foundation is going to be working with the FAA to help revitalize that program.
Mm-hmm. Bud, is that a good answer for you, or do you have anything else to say?
Well, that's a good answer, yeah. I have nothing else to say.
Okay, thanks for calling. Now I'd like to go to Doug, who's calling from Wasilla. Doug?
Oh, yeah. I was just wondering if there might be some kind of laws in place for the pilots to fly out of the lodges and maybe in the bush. I mean, if the weather was bad, they could say, well, we're just not going, and that's it, period. I mean, that there's no pressure that has to be put on them. Or is there no laws in place at all?
So in other words, could an operator fire, a bad operator fire a pilot who says, I don't want to fly, or does that pilot just have the final say-so? I don't know. I know pilots are supposed to have the say-so.
Well,
Jerry?
They fly under Part 91, so they really don't have the rules that we do as carriers. So, but they're still supposed to, look at visibility, and, if they don't have that, they're not supposed to fly. I mean, they're not just out there ruleless. They do have rules in place. And one of the things we've, in the last year or so that we've started the Medallion Foundation, we do have a single pilot program now for the 135 guys. So that gives them some
owner-operator person, basically.
Right, owner-operator person. And that we see would work, and the lodges could have some, I think some of the things that came from the Stevens crash, the lodges could have some very simple things in place without doing a lot of training. Flight following being one, be it the cook, anybody can be trained that, is told when they're going to depart, when they're supposed to get there, and what time they expect to be back, so that if something does happen, someone there is paying attention.
Right.
What's going on. Risk assessments, another single pilot, simple form that, Medallion Foundation has all these forms, all these programs in place that we'll give to anybody that they can use themselves and look at themselves and, those are probably, it's just a culture thing and trying to get them to. But, under 91, they don't have the strict rules we do maybe as a 135 mm-hmm. or 121 operator, but they still have to abide by weather and those kind of rules.
Mary, let me turn to you. I know that in every occupation, safety is going to, some extent, be determined by the relationship between the employer and the employee. Do pilots have enough protection in terms of saying to an employer, no, we don't. I don't think this is safe. Has that been an issue? I know, you know, there's other industries, obviously, where it is. Like, you know, it's terrible, the coal mining disaster, where obviously miners are told, go down there or you're fired, and then there's an accident. So address that, if you will.
I think it depends from operator to operator. As our caller Bud mentioned, he allows pilots to take a safe option and sit on the ground when the weather's bad, and I commend that policy. Mm-hmm. I think it would be great if all operators had that type of policy, and the pilot is ultimately the one who is responsible for the safe flight, but the amount of pressure that an operator can put on a pilot, it can be very difficult for pilots.
Yeah. Let me ask you, you know, the Circle of Safety program, I kind of remember when that went in effect, because there were some media commercials, you know, that were out there, and you heard those. I haven't heard those in quite a while, and I didn't know if there was a funding issue in keeping these things going, or how does that kind of come about to continue the programs.
The commercials are still available in print. Mm-hmm. I do notice them in the newspaper and occasionally on the radio. I am hoping that with the Medallion Foundation backing the FAA, that will give the program some more depth and maybe bring some new and fresh ideas into how to get these messages out. I think the link to the Circle of Safety program is on your website.
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm.
And there is a great booklet that's available for passengers or even pilots who may be flying commercially in Alaska. And it gives passengers some background on what they can expect, what are acceptable visibilities, what is a good time for a passenger to ask questions. For example, during takeoff or landing is not a good time to ask questions. Giving them ideas about you know, shipping cargo separately and not pressuring a pilot to take extra baggage that may overload the airplane, being flexible about taking a later flight or postponing for a day or two. There are some really good ideas for passengers, and to give pilots a heads up on what they can expect in the Circle of Safety. It's a booklet, actually, that has the link on your website.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting concept because, you know, I can certainly imagine as a passenger not pressuring a pilot. I know the difference between saying, oh, you got to get us there, and not saying that. And I can imagine saying, you know what, I don't think I'm going to go today. But it's very hard for me to imagine saying to a pilot, gee, this doesn't seem safe, you know, because he's the authority figure on the aircraft. I'm not going to challenge his judgment. I mean, at least it would feel to me very uncomfortable to do that. Address that. I mean, your role as a passenger is sort of go or not go, I would think. No?
What the program does is help educate passengers into being smart shoppers.
Mm-hmm.
You're correct. Not having any idea, especially for somebody who may be new to Alaska or is desperate to get home or to just get into a place where they can get a shower, they can put a lot of pressure on a pilot.
Mm-hmm.
So recognizing when it's appropriate and when it's not appropriate are very helpful tools.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Brandon has a comment or a question about 135 safety, 135 being the air taxi regulations. Brandon?
Yeah. Well, I'm a private pilot, first of all, and I'm also a graduate of the air traffic control program at UAA, so I know a little bit about planes. But I was shocked a couple years ago to fly with a 135 operator and a VFR flight, you know, up over the Alaska Range, or to the other side, over to Iliamna. And the pilot basically he was an owner-operator, and there's a lot of pressure, obviously, to make money, but, I mean, his basic you know, homemade instrument arrivals to some of these airports were consisted of the satellite phone to call somebody on the ground to see what the visibility was at the airport, and then using a handheld GPS to descend through the clouds. And I was absolutely shocked at the level of recklessness and how dangerous it was. I mean, especially on the way back coming over Cook Inlet, you know, through the clouds for, you know, 4 or 5 minutes with, you know, zero separation from the clouds and zero separation from anybody else that might be out there on an instrument flight plan. And I guess I guess my comment really is there's a lot of pressure to make money, and if the owner operator gets into a pattern of doing stuff like that, it's only a matter of time before they. Nobody on the plane knew that what he was doing was completely illegal and completely unsafe. They thought it was just another normal flight and that he had instruments that kept us separated from things. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, in all reality, if the batteries were to fail on the small Garmin, there was nothing there at all. And, you know, by turning on a few de-ice boots before descending through the clouds for 5 minutes, it was absolutely reckless and really horrifying as a pilot to know that what this guy was doing was illegal and not safe at all. And I think it's pretty common practice out there, unfortunately, because if it wasn't for that, there was no way to get into these places for the most part. They didn't have instrument approaches, and, you know, he had come up with his own and figured that it was safe because it works before. I mean, it's only a matter of time before it doesn't work, but it's just a lot of people don't realize that in the industry that goes on a lot, like all day, every day, when there's weather problems.
That's a good idea to check for that medallion, I guess. Mary O'Connor, do you have a comment?
I do, and Brandon, I share your feelings. I was in the same situation myself. I knew that was not right, that was not safe, and it was absolutely terrifying. The FAA does have a program where you can call and report unsafe operations. Their number is 1-866-TEL-FAA, and you can call after the fact if you just see something happening. You can call and let them know. It can be anonymous, so you don't have to give your name. And that's what I would recommend.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you could be saving somebody's life if you get a pilot like that to be disciplined in some way. And, you know, I've been on flights there where I sort of had those doubts. But once you're on the flight, you're just in that person's, you're kind of in that person's hands. How does the, Jerry Rock from the Air Carriers Association, how does the medallion program deal with, make sure that kind of pilot is not flying for a medallion carrier? I mean, what are the sort of the things that you do? There's training. There's making sure you got the equipment on the plane.
Well, we anybody who's a medallion carrier goes through an audit process every year. They're audited once a year to make sure they're complying with all the programs that are in place. That's how they keep their 5 stars. We look at safety. We look at internal audit. They're auditing themselves. We look at maintenance and ground handling, operational control. So they're checked yearly, kind of to make sure they're adhering to their own programs. You know, a couple of comments is that the Medallion Foundation is putting another $150,000 in the Circle of Safety.
Oh, great!
Those programs do on TV do run at night, and you'd really be surprised. The public is paying attention to them. The FAA is telling the, you know, especially in Bush, Alaska, the public to, you know, make sure that the pilot's flying safely and you know, not to go on the flight if they have any doubts. And it's kind of, there's been some, you know, in some of the recent accidents, the NTSB, even though they're not here, has found that the passengers in these smaller planes are actually looking at the capstone equipment and seeing terrain and questioning the pilots in flight.
Yeah,
and there's actually been comments about, you know, them asking them if the capstone's on or why it's not lit up. So.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, that's actually a good spot to end. Passenger responsibility. This has been a really interesting hour. I really want to thank my guests, Mary O'Connor from NIOSH, Jerry Rock from the Air Carriers Association, for being with us. I've learned a lot. I expect our guests have, too. It's been really interesting. Coming up next week, Kathleen McCoy hosts a discussion featuring the daring do sport of ski jumping with guests from the Nordic Ski Association working to revive it at the Hilltop Ski Area. I guess there's no aviation equipment required. If you want to continue with the conversation, find us on Facebook. There's a spot there to make your comments and get involved. Hometown Alaska is on the web at alaskapublic.org, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Alaska Public. Pat Yak is the Vice President of Public Media. Dave Waldron was our audio engineer today. Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.